Gegen den Klimawandel unternimmt niemand etwas. Wer hat, dem wird gegeben werden. Und Frauen verdienen weniger. War ja immer schon so. Man ärgert sich und macht weiter. Was aber, wenn nicht? Wir haben eine Idee. Die Falter Arena macht die Bühne frei für Menschen und Projekte, die das Land verändern. Mein Name ist Eva Konzett. Ich leite das Politikressort im Falter. Und am Sonntag, den 26. Mai, veranstalten wir im Wiener Stadtsaal die nächste Falter Arena. Mit dabei unter anderem der ehemalige Politiker und Neosänger Matthias Strolz, Theresa Imre von Magda, Sonja Jöchtl von Love Politics oder Kari Ochsner von Ochsner Wärmepumpen. Machen statt jammern. Wir schauen uns an, wie das funktionieren kann. Kommen auch Sie vorbei. Alle Informationen und Tickets finden Sie unter falter.at/arena.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Die Erderhitzung ist kein Gefühl, aber mit vielen Gefühlen verbunden. Sorgen etwa oder Angst. Eine Veranstaltung gegen diese Ohnmacht ist Tipping Time, eine Klimakonferenz der Zivilgesellschaft. Von 9.5. bis 11.5. findet Tipping Time in Kooperation von Globe Art, Solektiv und Tangente St. Pölten statt und lädt ein zu Diskurs, Diskussionen und Workshops mit namhaften Vortragenden wie Nikolai Schulz und Friederike Otto. Weitere Informationen finden Sie auf www.tangentesanktpölten.at.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen im Falter Radio. Russische Stimmen zum Krieg, lautet der Titel dieser Sendung. Russlands staatlich gelenkte Medien sprechen unverdrossen von einer Spezialoperation, wenn vom Krieg gegen die Ukraine die Rede ist. Wladimir Putin, der den Angriff gegen das Nachbarland befohlen hat, musste letzten Monat durch eine Teilmobilmachung der Männer Russlands die eigenen Streitkräfte verstärken. Tausende junge Russen werden als Kanonenfutter in die Schlacht um Cherson im Süden der Ukraine geschickt. Wie die russische Gesellschaft auf die neue Lage reagiert, wird für die Zukunft entscheidend sein. Einen ungeschminkten Blick auf die russischen Verhältnisse hören Sie in dieser Sendung. Das Renner-Institut in Wien hat drei Expertinnen und Experten, die selbst aus Russland kommen, geladen, um über den Zustand der Zivilgesellschaft unter den Bedingungen des Krieges zu berichten. Hören Sie ungewöhnliche Zeugnisse aus Russland in englischer Sprache. Grigori Judin, politischer Philosoph von der Moskauer Sozialwissenschaftlichen Schule. Für Judin war die Auflösung der Menschenrechtsorganisation Memorial, die dieses Jahr den Friedensnobelpreis erhalten hat, ein Vorzeichen für den heranziehenden Krieg. Die Zeit der Zivilgesellschaften ist vorbei, sagt Judin aus Moskau. Dagegen ist eine Zeit für Widerstand in der Russischen Föderation angebrochen.
I think it is first not very helpful to think of civil society in Russia and second not really adequate to the realities on the ground because of what we've been witnessing even before 2022 and now in hindsight we understand it was a preparation to the war. So for instance the close down of Memorial is now we understand was definitely part of the preparation for the war. All those organizations that are capable of any kind of action were shut down well before the war. And now with the war, well, what kind of attributes of civil society do you have there? Do you have any sort of public discussion? I mean, some of the military bloggers are discussing with our military bloggers, how do we destroy Ukrainians? Well, that's a public discussion. Otherwise, no. Even minor concerns, and as we are moving further into this martial law, which I guess is very likely to be expanded, I mean, even those minor discussions become outlawed. Well, basically, you have no conditions for civil society, and I think a different concept that might be more helpful here to think of this opposite force, this force that could oppose the state, the concept of resistance. It is no longer time of civil society, I guess, but it's time of resistance.
Soweit der politische Philosoph Grigori Judin aus Moskau. Die Politikwissenschaftlerin Olga Guschina kommt aus St. Petersburg. Sie unterrichtet zurzeit in Deutschland. Sie sagt, die russische Zivilgesellschaft befindet sich weitgehend im Ausland. Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten, die noch im Land selbst sind, helfen Flüchtlingen aus der Ukraine, die es nach Russland verschlagen hat. Das sind Leute, die gegen den Krieg sind. Sie unterstützen junge Männer, die dem Kriegsdienst entgehen wollen, und sie verbreiten ganz einfach unzensurierte Nachrichten über den Krieg, so Politikwissenschaftlerin Olga Guschina aus St. Petersburg.
Since the beginning of this awful war, political in Russian means anti-war, because there are no other issues that are important in the country. And what we see now, if we try to find a kind of civil society in Russia, we should pay attention to the people who are actually have been civic and political activists in Russia, and they have to leave the country. And we are observing literally an exodus from Russia, and the most active people have this choice. Either we to keep silence and keep on doing our small projects, or we leave the country and start something new. There are people who are still staying in Russia, and what do they do? There are actually three main options that we have to help Ukrainian refugees, and it can be also considered like quite a dangerous thing, because sometimes and very often it is an evidence of anti-war position. The second thing that people can do is to help people to leave Russia and to help those who have left Russia and are staying now in some visa-free countries. The third one is to help people to spread the information about war and to spread the information about the mobilization, about the ways how to escape from the mobilization, and to try to break this wall of not understanding what's going on.
Soweit Olga Guschina, die Politikwissenschaftlerin aus St. Petersburg. Elena Lipilina vertritt Sportlerinnen und Sportler der LGBTQ-Community von Lesben, Gays und anderen sexuellen Minderheiten in Russland. Sie lebt im Exil und verweist auf die schlimmen Auswirkungen, die es für die russische Zivilgesellschaft hat, dass immer mehr EU-Staaten es Staatsbürgern aus der Russischen Föderation schwerer machen, Visa zu bekommen. Schengen-Visa sind für Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten kein Luxus, sondern ein Ausweg, wenn sie in Gefahr sind, sagt Elena Lipilina.
For a long time, the Schengen visa was not a privilege. It was something that you needed to have in a passport to flee the country quickly. I mean, lots of people who, you know, knew the risks had it. You know, they always had a valid passport. They always had a Schengen visa. It was, you know, for many people, not a luxury, you know, of seeing Paris. It was actually the way to get through the border quickly and outside the country. And, you know, now with the, you know, with the borders literally being shut down, lots of people are feeling very, you know, just, you know, depressed is not the word that covers it, but, you know, they're feeling lost and they're feeling isolated from the rest of the world. And that's the feeling that is quite mutual. So they're isolated within the country. The government says, you know, we don't want you. And they're isolated from the outer world because the outer world says, oh, you're Russians, first of all.
Soweit die russische LGBTQ-Aktivistin Elena Lipilina. Das waren Ausschnitte aus einem Meinungsaustausch im Karl-Renner-Institut, bei dem es tiefgehende Einblicke in die russische Gesellschaft im Krieg gibt. Die Diskussionsleitung hat Stefanie Fenkert. Wie passt überhaupt der Begriff der Zivilgesellschaft auf das heutige Russland, lautet die Frage zu Beginn, die Grigori Judin anspricht.
The idea of civil society, of course, comes from a very specific intellectual tradition, namely a liberal one. Idea behind this concept is the juxtaposition of the state and civil society so as to leave for civil society sort of room for communication, public communication, that would, to a certain extent, at least curtail the state or limit the state and create an area for independent action. The idea of civil society and the concept of civil society gained considerable traction in Russia in the 90s with the liberal reforms. And we saw a rise of NGOs, which are interestingly called in Russia NKO, which is non-commercial organizations. And that actually tells a lot about how the whole thing is framed in Russia. It was exactly in the 90s, but mostly after the 2012, that it became relatively clear that civil society is imagined by the state as a strictly apolitical domain, which kind of contradicts the initial concept of civil society, because as we know from Habermas, for instance, that civil society actually has a lot of potential for political reforms. And it often happens so that free communication and public speech, development of public sphere, precedes some political reforms. And this is a technology for limiting, for restraining the state, and later for attaining some political aims. With this new image of civil society, it almost became a demand for it to become completely depoliticized. And interestingly, it was at this point that where so many organizations flourishing that would accept this label of NKO and start working in an apolitical way, but still promoting some sort of solidarity between the people. And what they discovered very soon was that any kind of activity like that, if it is successful enough, very quickly turns them, guess what, political. Because actually there is no basic definition of what is political and what is not political. Every time you gather people, you engage them in collective action, even if it's like caring about dogs. It has some potential of becoming political. Either it develops its own political agenda, as it happens, for instance, with associations of cyclists in Moscow, who at some point started making the political demands, and they were immediately disbanded after that. Even if it abstains from doing that, it still contains some potential for future political action when there is a necessity. So when there is some sort of political shock, people start looking around, thinking of who could they organize with, and they immediately come across their peers in these organizations. So that started a long and, I think, not very productive discussion within Russia whether it makes sense to stick to the law, because the law is the issue here, of course. The law tells that these organizations are basically forbidden to engage in political activities. Some of them would accept that. Believing that kind of raising this solidarity from below would, in the end, have some transformative effect on the system. So they would strictly adhere to the law and admit that they're apolitical. Some of them would do it, how was it, a tactical move, But many of them would do it wholeheartedly, and it was always a case with Russian activists that when some sort of protest starts happening, you immediately see people saying, no, it's not about politics. It's not about politics. We don't want your politicians here. We just want to get our things solved. And then you have a different group who was suspecting from the very beginning that that's not going to help. That's not a working strategy. That the situation will deteriorate, and if you abstain from political intervention, you actually help your opponent pressure you further. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I think the events of 2022 settled the whole argument. The second party won, I guess. It was probably a mistake to count on these civil society initiatives as a transformative potential. And renouncing the political action, hoping that some sort of opportunity might emerge later. So now I think it is first not very helpful to think of civil society in Russia, and second, not really adequate to the realities on the ground because of what we've been witnessing even before 2022, and now in hindsight we understand it was a preparation to the war. So for instance, the close down of Memorial is, now we understand, was definitely part of the preparation for the war, because Memorial is one of those apolitical or seemingly apolitical organizations who were able to gather a lot of people, and of course their Nobel Prize is well deserved. I mean, they did a terrific job that will definitely pay out in the future. But they were gathering people around those public memories of mainly of repressions, but not only of the repressions, also of the World War II, for instance. And at the same time, they were kind of helping the political organization. And all those organizations that were capable of any kind of action were shut down well before the war. And now with the war, well, what kind of attributes of civil society do you have there? Do you have any sort of public discussion? I mean, some of the military bloggers are discussing with our military bloggers, how do we destroy Ukrainians? Well, that's a public discussion. You can call it civil society, perhaps. Otherwise, no. Even minor concerns, and as we are moving further into this martial law, which I guess is very likely to be expanded, I mean, even those minor discussions become outlaw. Well, basically, you have no conditions for civil society, and I think a different concept, and I'll stop at that, a different concept that might be more helpful here to think of this, you know, opposite force, this force that could oppose the state, the concept of resistance. It is no longer time of civil society, I guess, but it's time of resistance. And it, I think it pays tribute to this sort of regime that we are facing in Russia right now, but also it does justice to this failed strategy of building some sort of civil society. Even though some people still nurture these hopes in Russia, significantly less of them, but I think history showed they were wrong. So it's time for resistance.
Thank you very much, Greg. And I think this already leads me to you, Olga Agustina. She is a guest researcher at the Institute of Political Science in Hagen Fern University. And after, I mean, it was just quite critical what Greg has been saying, and Memorial was mentioned. I mean, it just was granted a Nobel Peace Prize. But then we also know that, I mean, press freedom and media freedom is, I would say, not even nowadays existing in Russia. And the same is also true when it comes to social media. I mean, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, like all of those channels are quite either forbidden or restricted. After what Greg just said, that it's very, very difficult, like in this super narrow space, like, do you think that there is still some room for civil society? And then maybe since you also deal a lot with democracy, I mean, maybe you can also share your idea. I mean, what does democracy actually mean for Russian society? Because I think this is also a very, very difficult notion when it comes to the essence of democracy, which is of course more than elections, fair and free elections. But please, of course, also be feel free to react to what Greg has been saying. So the floor is yours.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hear about the situation in Russian civil society, I would just say Russian society, because civil society, it's really a tiny part of Russian society. And it happens so that I have a great and huge experience of, so to say, participatory observation in St. Petersburg, because I was not only a political scientist there, but I was also a part of regional opposition, and I know personally many civic projects, political projects, and all these people who are facing now the repressions in Russia. Many of them are coming from St. Petersburg, and many of them are my friends, and it's really a very sensitive topic for us. And let me say a few words just about the general concept of democracy that we are seeing in Russia now. And it is understood in Russia in generally, we are not speaking about the intellectuals or activists, but in general, it is understood in a very simplistic way. So democracy for Russian is the power of the majority. And that's why the regime has been for the years constructing this image of majority, or the absolute majority that supports a Russian president, Russian government. So what have we, what could we observe? Falsified elections, even the presidential one, and we are quite sure that in these circumstances, when we have completely absence of opposition in the, there is completely forbidden for real opposition to participate in the elections. Could Mr. Putin win elections without falsification? Yes, of course. But for example, 53% is not enough to create this image of absolute support. That's why they need to falsify election and to show that there was a huge turnout and the support is around 70%. That's why they are publishing various opinion polls that are conducted in very special conditions. I don't want to go to domain of Professor Yudin to speaking more about sociology. Anyhow, we see that all these notions about support for various actions and decisions of Russian government, Russian president, are around 70-80%. So it's a kind of magic numbers that need to show the Russian society that there is an absolute support of Russian politics inside the country. And also, what do they have? They have lots of NGOs that are dependent on budget funding, and that's why they should demonstrate their loyalty in order to keep on doing the good things they intended to do. And yes, they think that their concept of small good actions, they can change something in the country, but on their like official and public level, they should demonstrate loyalty to the government. And we see also lots of letters like support all the special military operations. And the see, of course, the work of troll fabrics that are producing thousands of comments in social media, creating the picture that, like, everyone and the absolute majority is supporting a Russian president and supporting Putin's regime. And so this is a picture of absolute majority is in line with the politics of the president, and vice versa. President follows the will of Russian people, and that's why it is fine. It is this kind of sovereign democracy. And this concept lays in the ground of the processes that we see in Russia. So this is their kind of democracy, how they understand that. And many people who are not so sophisticated in the issues of politics and social sciences. And we know that we had a huge problem with the education, actually it's the issue of political culture. And that's why, yes, there are many people who are in line with this kind of situation, and they can consider that what happens in Russia is like democracy. And so it's kind of a vicious circle. And when we speak about the mass media and about journalists in Russia, there is a huge problem in this sphere, because those independent journalists who couldn't leave country with their media outlets like Novaya Gazeta or Meduza or TV Rain, so they have to start their own small media projects, and they are struggling to find some funding to lead their projects, and they are struggling to have an access to audience, because actually if a person in Russia wants to have some kind of alternative information, it's not that like impossible. There is Telegram. So Telegram channels are extremely popular among those who is looking for some alternative news in Russia. There is YouTube, and it's also like going very popular. And many, many Russians know how to use VPN in order to access blocked websites and social media. So it's not a huge problem in these terms. But there is a problem that we go back to political culture and the lack of media literacy and lack of political literacy. People just don't know that it's not enough to watch TV news and one should try to find an alternative perspective in order to make his own opinion. That's the issue. And it's a huge problem for the independent mass media in reaching this audience that is not so well aware about the political processes in the country. And I would say that there is a growing demand in order to find this alternative sources of information and to increase some kind of political literacy and to understand what's actually going on. And speaking about the political participation in Russia, I can add that since the beginning of this awful war, political in Russian means anti-war. Because there are no other issues that are important in the country. Because we had like municipal elections in Moscow, but it was completely nonsense because it's the municipal deputies cannot change anything. And there was like a couple of years ago, there was a hope that people who come to local politics can change the landscape. And the last success story was in St. Petersburg, in my hometown. Then in 2019, over 200 independent municipal deputies have been elected. But just in half of the year, there was announcement about the changes to the constitution. And it has already then became all clear that there will be no positive political changes in the country, and all these activities on the local level will just go in vain. What we see now, if we try to find a kind of civil society in Russia, we should pay attention to the people who actually have been civic and political activists in Russia, and they have to leave the country. And we are observing literally an exodus from Russia, and the most active people who had absolutely wonderful civic and political projects in Russia. I can give like a couple of examples, like the director of charity organization in Russia, Nachleshka. In English, it will be like Night Shelter. It was a absolutely fantastic NGO. It was really one of the best examples of civic society organization in Russia. So he has decided to abandon the organization and to leave country because he was afraid to harm to this NGO because he has anti-war position. And it's true. So people have this choice. Either we just keep silence and keep on doing our small projects, or we leave the country and start something new. And there are lots of activists who are in Georgia, in Armenia now, in Serbia, in Turkey, and at the moment there are like 54 applications from municipal deputies are in the consideration of Foreign Office of Germany. These people are waiting for the approval of humanitarian visa. So it means that we will have now the Russian civil society in exile. So it's the civil society that we have. And there are people who are still staying in Russia. And what do they do? There are actually three main options that we have to help Ukrainian refugees. And it can be also considered like quite a dangerous thing because sometimes and very often it is an evidence of anti-war position. And there are many people who are trying, for instance, to Ukrainian refugees who have been forcibly displaced from Donetsk and Lugansk region to leave Russia through Estonia and Finland. And the second thing that people can do is to help people to leave Russia and to help those who have left Russia and are staying now in some visa-free countries. And they're arranging shelters, consultations, arranging psychological help to those who have left Russia. And the third one is to help people to spread the information about war and to spread the information about the mobilization, about the ways how to escape from the mobilization and to trying to break this wall of not understanding what's going on.
Thank you very much, Olga. I think you mentioned many, many important things. I mean, the brain drain, I think, is very important. But also what we have already been discussing today, also Greg and me, is the situation of the support of Ukrainian refugees being in Russia, which is something we do not really hear a lot here in Austria. And I'm pretty sure also not so much in the other Western countries. And since you also mentioned like all the media outlets, which more or less needed to shut down also because of financial reasons, because of the foreign agent law, and also because they were not really able to attract people anymore during to pay walls and all the other things. And I remember quite vividly that Dost was one of it. I saw a documentary here in where they actually tackled this issue in a very prominent way. Thank you very much. And our last but definitely not least speaker is Elena Lipilina. I'm sorry for that one. She's the president of the Russian LGBTIQ Sports Federation.
In exile again,
the third now. But maybe as you just heard, I mean, Greg was saying it's very difficult actually talking even about civil society. Is it even still existing? I wouldn't even say so. And then Olga was also saying similar things, how difficult it is, and they are very, very narrow. And then we also do know that, of course, a war always goes hand in hand with a decline in human rights and a decline of liberal freedoms and all the other issues which are coming there. Nevertheless, I mean, I would say especially the LGBTIQ scene always has been quite under pressure in Russia. But then again, Russia is a huge country and there are many different regions. And I know for sure that, for example, in Chechnya, it's even worse than, for example, I'm guessing in St. Petersburg. Chechnya, I mean, a lot of Muslim population with Kadyrov being the lead of the country where many LGBTIQ people are tortured and even murdered. And it's difficult and also to get them out of the country. And this is also, so my question would be from your experience, I mean, how do you see the situation, especially from your civil society community, which is very important. And then again, I mean, with also this new introduction of visa restrictions, I mean, I guess it's very important, especially for people from civil society to get to support and also to get out of the country and also to have like, I don't know, like a link to other countries. And is this still there? And how would you assess the situation? And did it worsen a lot since the war? And was there even, if at all, any progress before that?
Thank you for the question and thank you for having me here. To answer it step by step, it didn't even start in 2014 when the law on gay propaganda was adopted. It actually started in 2006 when the regions were given authority to decide on gay propaganda, and a couple of regions were not even including Chechnya. It was St. Petersburg, Moscow, and Ryazan for some reason, and a couple of others, Nizhny Novgorod. So the process started long before, you know, it reached some sort of a conclusion in 2014 with the law on gay propaganda for the minors, and that was an important point. And for the civil society or the lack of whereof, that was a case in point that, okay, you know, it's for the minors, maybe it's not that bad, you know, it's not an omen of something worse to come. We're not yet Gilead, we're not yet Afghanistan or Iran, but we are, you know, we can manage, we can make it happen, and, you know, maybe we slap the plus 18 on the entrance on our, you know, on our event, and that's not going to happen to us. But the problem with this is that the Russian government creates an intentionally porous legal framework. So within that framework, basically, you need to pay attention to whatever is targeted. And if it says LGBTIQ, it targets LGBTIQ. It doesn't matter what follows after that. The words propaganda, minors, it doesn't even matter. You know, what matters is you're under pressure, you're the target of this. So this is exactly what happened. You know, my organization, following what Professor Yudin said, was one of those NGOs that chose the you know, the path of not saying we're doing political things. We had lots of discussions within our board on whether, you know, sport is political or apolitical, and we are to date the only still registered LGBTIQ organization in Russia, the only one still standing. I don't know for how long. I don't think for long. You know, we haven't been slapped with a foreign agent's label yet, because, you know, sport is something beyond the radars. We've been having our organization, our events that are, again, flying under some sort of a radar. Not really, because, you know, we've been denied, you know, venues. We had police raids coming in. We had participants being attacked. So all those things, you know, they started happening and they were escalating. So the thing is, as soon as, you know, this law in 2014 was adopted, no one was safe anymore. And that was an omen of something worse to come. You're right about that. You know, it's the suppression on civil liberties that start with LGBTIQ. LGBTIQ was always the contentious topic within the Russian society. And again, following what, you know, Professor Gushina said, it always was presented as the will of the majority. You know, we, the Russian people, hate the gays, you know. You know, and the only true marriage is between a man and a woman. And this is the rhetoric that is being now repeated. And the scary development for everyone now happened yesterday. There was a public discussion of the gay propaganda, no minors, just gay total ban on gay propaganda. LGBT homosexual propaganda, but it doesn't change the content. The whole discussion was a full-on travesty. You know, the sort of arguments given there ranged from, you know, Spider-Man and Peppa the Pig. I mean, seriously, these are representatives of the state that are mentioning this sort of arguments as, you know, people and people needing protection from those kind of displays of homosexual behavior. These kind of arguments lead to an eventual, you know, acceptance of this law. So lots of organizations that are already abroad, you know, again, trying to address the second part of the question, most of the LGBTIQ organizations have already fled the country. You know, they were a part of this exodus. They are trying to help from beyond the borders. But the problem is this, they cannot access the funds either way. So whenever LGBTIQ organization that fled to, let's say, Lithuania, we know those, lots of them are settled down in Vilnius, for example, they cannot have any project that would impact the community in Russia that would help other activists flee because of the funds. There is no way they can access it. There was no way they can wire it. There is no way they, you know, they can help. And also the visas, because for a long time, the Schengen visa was not a privilege. It was something that you needed to have in a passport to flee the country quickly. I mean, lots of people who, you know, knew the risks had it. You know, they always had a valid passport. They always had a Schengen visa. It was, you know, for many people, not a luxury. And I've seen Paris. It was actually the way to get through the border quickly and outside the country. And, you know, now with the, you know, with the borders literally being shut down, lots of people are feeling very, you know, just, you know, depressed is not the word that covers it, but, you know, they're feeling lost and they're feeling isolated from the rest of the world. And that's the feeling that is quite mutual. So they're isolated within the country. The government says, you know, we don't want you. And they're isolated from the outer world because the outer world says, oh, you're Russians, first of all. You know, it doesn't matter if you're the LGBT, you're the Russians. And I've had these cases as a representative. I'm a board member of the European Gay and Lesbian Sports Federation, and there were some talks at the level of Eurogames, which is the annual sports event for the LGBTIQ, that they should not have the Russian LGBTIQ at the event because they are Russian. And there was no discussion at that point that, you know, we had to raise it, of course, because I was like, how? Of course, again, like LGBTIQ is not, a homogenous class. Of course, there can be different, you know, different views within that class. It doesn't automatically mean, you know, the person who's LGBTIQ is anti-war. I cannot say that. I won't vouch for that. But the percentage, you know, is marginal. And you shouldn't really exclude someone who's LGBTIQ and is the same oppressed class from being able to access safety. And this is something that's happening right now. You know, people are being denied safe spaces just on the basis of being Russians. And I don't think that's, you know, that's the way to go. I think it's very discouraging for, you know, the civil society, well, I mean, the advocacy organizations, you know, not using the word that Professor Yudin kind of avoids, but for the advocacy organizations, it makes it increasingly hard because they have to bear the brunt of being Russians first and foremost, and then being something, you know, anti-war, LGBTIQ, trying to do some good. You know, they have to deal with this label first, and they have to deal with that immediate knee-jerk reaction when you say, "Where do you come from?" And they're like, you know, it's really important. It's very, you know, detrimental to the whole situation. So the problem is that there is willingness to help, especially now that the advocacy organizations are in safe spaces. The Russian LGBT community is not, and more than ever. Of course, again, since the discussions were kind of a farce, they lack public support because that's the straw that the government seems to be grasping, and it's on one level. On another level, it's just a, I would say it's a programmatic statement. You know, LGBTIQ is something from the West, and the West is sodomic and corrupt. So we, it's like, you know, it's the evil West that is pushing those values that we do not accept. So LGBTIQ are part of the evil West package that is now being targeted. There is no kind of, there is no public support because the public is now really, is, you know, there are bigger things to do for the public right now. Also to flee, also to, you know, get away from the martial law and the forced mobilization. So there is no basis for that. But it is programmatic and it is going to get worse. It is going to be implemented randomly or, you know, with aim. But it's something that's been long coming, and we're now all facing that, you know, Gilead of state. I use that term deliberately because, I mean, it's not an imaginary state. It's actually right there in Russia right now. I mean, call it a failed state or whatever state, but it's pretty much, you know, it's pretty much true. And it is going to be, you know, non-men and non-women because, I mean, the amendments to the Constitution also made it possible. You know, the amendments that only a man and a woman can be married under the side of law, you know, that's enshrined in the Constitution. So this, you know, current law is a direct attack on the community. Again, like what can be done is access to safety, whatever that safety means for lots of people, be it, you know, the access to funds to help those, or be it the access to the safer countries and expedited visa processes. But there needs to be safety because now it's, I'm using harsh words, it's a catastrophe for everyone, including the LGBTIQ.
Thank you so much. I was going to ask you what we can do, what the West can do, actually. So you already answered it, but thank you so much. But before I go into the audience, I would also like to give the same question also to you, Greg. I mean, what could the West in general do? But before you answer that question, since you also brought it up, is about this polling situation, you know, because we in the West, we have been hearing since the beginning of the war. And when I say the beginning of the war, I mean now, unfortunately, 24th of February, we know it already started in 2014. But I mean, since February 24th, we've been hearing that the Russians are in favor of the war and that they are supporting it, and that like all of Russians are like this. And we know that polls, especially in a very repressive surrounding, it's very difficult to grasp like what lies behind it. So since you're a sociologist, I would like to take the opportunity also that you can explain us just a little bit what can we take out of it about this polling and what the difficulty is with polling, especially when it comes to the situation we are now in. And please also tackle the question what the West could do to support, I don't know, this resistance movement or anything like you said, or I don't know, like to grasp the responsibility since you say civil society is not really what is now there, what we can support in this sense. But I don't know, a feeling of responsibility is still also there and should be also supported, I would say, also in Russian society, which might be apolitical. Maybe it's different than for the younger generation than for the older ones.
Yeah, thank you. Well, basically, but you, Stephanie, I think you prefigured the answers. So the main thing we have to understand about Russian society is that it completely politicized society. So people not only have no interest in politics, very much disenchanted about politics, but also perceive it as, dangerous, but dangerous is not a thing. It's idiotic. If you're interested in politics, you're stupid. Business people wouldn't run anything together with someone who's interested in politics. It's like you are so naive that you don't understand something very, very basic about how things work in the world. never, ever has anyone engaged in politics changed anything in the world. So this is a complete depoliticization. And that leads to outsourcing of political issues to the leadership, which is also not good, obviously. But, I mean, they are there anyway, and probably they know better. And with all those opinion polls, this is the way they are interpreted in Russia. So let's start with the fact that the response rates in Russia are very low. They are generally low. That's not only a Russian problem, but in Russia, this has specific significance because people who would engage in responding to opinion polls, they would normally perceive it as something conducted by the state. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. This is the image of opinion polls. And so if someone is asked by the pollster to participate, well, the chances are that they will decline. And the response rates are, I mean, after the war started, say 5 to 7%. But even if they would accept it, they would interpret it as an interaction with the state on the matters which people have no expertise in. This idea of outsourcing all things political to the leadership leads to very strong sensitivity to questions like, do you support something? Because if it is perceived as a decision taken by the leader, well, yeah, of course I do support that. The leader knows better. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had this wonderful poll by Russian Field where Russians were asked if they would support Vladimir Putin if he ends the war right now, just like it is. It was 75% for that. And then the next question, do you support Vladimir Putin if he launches a second assault on Kyiv? 60% for that. That tells you everything you need to know about that. The question is not, do you support some specific policy, but do you support the president? And that's it. So 40% support whatever the president wants to do. If he wants us to fly to Mars, we're happy to do that. Particularly if I'm not involved. I mean, if somebody wants to fly everyone to Mars, let it be, but please leave me alone. So this is the message that you would normally hear from Russian people. This is bad. This is really bad, but this is a different type of disease. This is not a massive support for war, like engagement, aggression. This is indifference, complete disenchantment, nihilism. Those are very bad things, but this is a different sort of disease. And then you have, you have this militarized minority, small but very vocal, that is meant to represent the Russian people. Well, they are the audience of those vampires you would see on those TV shows. It's like 15 to 20% perhaps. But they're aggressive, and that's a lot. On the other hand, you have 15 or 20 or 25% of people who are opposed to the war. They are silent now because they have no opportunities to speak. And then you have everyone in the middle. So that was for the first question, but I'm happy to answer more if there are any. Now about the role of the West. Well, I think it has to do something with civil society. Look, I think all of us, but I'm speaking about my own experience, I had this experience with people from Europe, really investing a lot of effort and money in building Russian civil society. For quite a while, I was wondering what the hell they were doing. That was my problem, for instance, with the German foundations. I mean, they really did a very good job supporting many important initiatives. I was happy to cooperate with them. But looking at that, I was seeing they're pushing really hard on developing civil society. But at the same time, on the other hand, channeling incredible money into Putin's pockets, and it was completely clear what would this money serve for. So what's the idea? Why are you doing something with one hand which is immediately destroyed by the other hand? What is the idea of financing these people who are definitely going to destroy civil society, something you are investing in? What's the logic? This was something I was not getting, but that also reflects the issue with the idea of civil society. Because there was this belief in a magic effect of civil society. Well, if we invest in civil society, probably it will grow and it will change. But how? If all the money are on the side of the repressive state. So I think actually the West, the so-called West, also fell in this very trap of believing that civil society is something that automatically will help and at the same time enabling Russian government, which was very, very clear in what it was going to do. So I think once again the whole ideology was wrong, and it's time to get over this ideology. I think that the lives of specific people who are suffering now, as far as I'm concerned, it is important, but it is a humanitarian issue. Supporting this civil society in exile, as you have it very, very clearly, is not a way to change the situation in Russia. That's not going to happen. It never helped. It's not going to help. But stopping to finance this government, which hasn't occurred yet, and if you're interested, I'm happy to elaborate on that. It definitely hasn't stopped yet. This is help. This is something that will help. And let me push it to the limit, and will be the final point. Behind all that, there is this looming question. I've faced it many times. Why Russians are not protesting? Why Russians are not rebelling? There are several answers to that. But one of them is that Russians are basically dealing with the very same people who are now killing dozens of thousands of people in Ukraine. And it would be a fantasy to imagine that they would spare Russians of that fate. It requires a completely different framing. Raising civil society within Russia would change nothing about these people who are already hell-bent on killing no matter how many people. So that requires thinking of it in terms of resistance. I haven't heard of anyone suggesting delivering arms to Russians. But I'm hearing all the time delivering arms to Ukrainians, which is probably right. But in that case, like, what's the difference between you Russians and Ukrainians? They're facing the same enemy. And that's also true of Belarusians, of course. Facing the same enemy. So what's the expectation of facing this enemy with so different means?
Thank you very much, Greg. I think this was also a very, very blunt statement, and also the same for you. I mean, what do you think? What could the West probably do more? And also, I mean, since you are a researcher, I mean, how do you also see like this cultural exchange or the possibility to cooperate, you know, between Russians and also the Western world? Because I feel and I see it's becoming increasingly more difficult also to cooperate even in the scientific research field or whatever. So, I mean, what would you say? Could the West do better? And please also feel free to reflect on what Greg just said and, of course, also what Olga said before.
Thank you. First, I would like to say that when we speak about what can West do, I think I completely agree with Professor Yudin that we can't help to Russian society or Russian civil society as a whole thing. There are only activists who are in danger and who should be saved somehow. And I think it's really important because we speak about people and it's actually about the European, democratic, liberal, whatever values. And it's about the human rights. And the most, I would say, difficult and depressing thing for the activists who are still staying in Russia and who are risking their normal lives, their not only their careers, like they can lose some jobs or they are choosing to work in NGOs, but not to pursue some brilliant careers or whatever. People really put a lot of efforts to change something in Russia. And their core idea was to bring these Europeans to Russia. And these are the people who have been convincing their fellow citizens that Europe, the West, is not an enemy to Russia. And there is no hatred towards Russians. And there is no discrimination. And we had a huge wave of such kind of messages on mass media or in Russia that Russians are subject to discrimination. And it were the Russians, the activists inside the country and outside the country who has been confronting this idea and telling that no, there is no such kind of discrimination. And now then the borders are closed. So we have been afraid of closure of the Russian borders by Putin. We were afraid that the new Iron Curtain will fall from the Russian side, but not from the side of Finland or from the Baltic states. And unfortunately, Russia doesn't have the borders with all the countries or the Schengen Agreement. And that's why there are only few points of entry to the European Union. And now we see that people who are trying to escape from Russia have this way closed. And we see the activists who have been helping those people to leave Russia and who had this hope that they can escape it if it becomes even worse. Because there are still many people who are staying in Russia and who are hoping to go through this difficult period, but not to leave their country because it's complicated. It's very complicated. It's a big tragedy that a person has to leave his home country, not on his own will, but because of some dangers and some threats. And then those people, those activists, see the actually national discrimination. Then people are not let into European Union and are told that it is a privilege for Russian to have the freedom of movement. And they are starting to have really big doubts about actually the European values. I have seen like dozens of such kind of messages, comments from the people who I know personally, and I have no doubts about their principles and values. And see how these people who are actually the they have created a huge basement for this emergent civil society in Russia. Now they have doubts in those values. It looks for them like actually Mr. Putin was right. There are double standards in Western countries. There is discrimination in Europe against Russians, and basis of their values, this core of European values and their desire to build democracy in Russia is under threat, because they see this attitude, they see real facts. I'm not speaking about some fake news spread by propaganda media. I mean first-hand stories. And I see like people are starting to think maybe we don't need these Western values if there are no true value of human life and there is no true wish to save people irrespectively of their origin. And I think it's a huge issue that we can lose actually those few people who are still staying in Russia and who are still so naive that they still believe in democracy. It is the perspective they are seen inside Russia. So they are naive, they believe to good Europeans and Americans, but it's all corrupted. Now these people unfortunately see some signals that yes, the European democracy can be corrupted and it's not that ideal like they wanted to see it. And I think it's the one, it's more about some kind of moral issue they're facing. And the second very big issue I see, and what I think European politicians should think about, there is a quite big group of political prisoners in Russia who are literally in jail. And Russian opposition is not a party to any kind of negotiation with Russian government. So there is no one who will represent the interests of these people. So literally they have to wait until the Putin's regime falls in jail. And I'm not speaking about Alexei Navalny or Vladimir Karamurza, who have made some kind of choice to stay in Russia, to come to Russia, and then to be imprisoned. But I speak about the people like Alexander Skocilenko, who has placed 4 price tags informing about the war crimes in Ukraine in a nearby supermarket. She is in jail since the end of April. She has a genetic disease and her health is literally deteriorating because she must have special diet. And in prison, it's completely impossible. And I don't know, will she actually survive this time of imprisonment? And so there is Alexei Gorinov, who has been sentenced for 7 years just for speaking up against war at the municipal council. So there are actually many people, more than 100 of persons, who have been placed into some kind of detention because of their anti-war position. And I think that when Western countries are trying to negotiate with the Russian government, and then they are considering imposing new sanctions or lifting some sanctions, probably it will be a good humanitarian step to include this list of people who are imprisoned now to some kind of deal. Because, yes, there is also the famous list of FBK of 6,000 corrupted civil servants and oligarchs and propaganda workers and so on who are in charge of this regime. But also there should be a list of people who one should try to save, because they're really in danger. And so they're already in absolutely awful conditions of Russian prisons, and there is no other party who can raise a voice to help them.
Thank you very much. Would you still like to add something to what Greg said or Olga said?
I mean, it's pretty full as it is, but I mean, it is on one hand a humanitarian issue when, you know, you're getting out the people who are vulnerable, but also it is a matter with LGBTIQ specifically, it is a matter of, you know, public consciousness in a way. So when we're saying, you know, the will of majority is being manipulated, it is. But the problem is that, you know, once Putin's regime falls, and eventually it will fall, we will be dealing with the same set of heritage that this regime left, and homophobia will be one of them, because at some point in 2014 or 2006, it doesn't really matter, at some point it was institutionalized. This violence has been institutionalized, this homophobia has been institutionalized, and it's a huge amount of work to overthrow this part of heritage. And again, like activists who are now brought in safer spaces and people who fled could be an asset to this. I mean, not now, of course, but in some time. So letting them live and letting them be safer is actually a huge, you know, it can have a huge impact on what, you know, Russia will be post Putin, because this is, I guess, what we are all waiting for in one, you know, way or another.
Das war eine Diskussion im Karl-Renner-Institut in Wien am 19.10.2022 unter der Leitung von Stefanie Fenker, diskutierten Olga Gruschina, Grigori Judin und Elena Lipilina. Beim Renner-Institut bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Aktuelle Berichte aus Russland und über den Ukraine-Krieg gibt es im Falter, jede Woche. Daher ist ein Abonnement des Falter wichtig, um auf dem Laufenden zu bleiben. Alle Informationen finden Sie im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.